This is Brendan Whiteman from Cambridge University Press talking to Andy Kirkpatrick on the publication of his new book, World Englishes. Firstly, congratulations, Andrew, on a fantastic book, which I think, above all, is extremely accessible to the layperson. I've got a few questions for Andrew. I'm going to kick off with the first one. Andy, you talk about Catru's concentric circles in your book. Could you please explain what you mean by them?
Well, Catru originally developed this formulation of these concentric circles, which he called inner, outer, and expanding. And by inner circle, he meant those countries in which English is traditionally used as a first language, places like the United Kingdom, for example, where there are native speakers of English are the norm, and English is the official and language of the nation. Then he talked about outer circle countries. These were typically countries that had been a colony of either Britain, mostly Britain, or of the United States, where English had obtained some kind of institutional status. So after independence, English remained an important language, and these countries have often developed so-called new varieties of English. So places like Malaysia, Singapore, for example, will have Malaysian English, Singaporean English, and places where English still plays a very important institutional role. The third circle, as it were, that Catru talked about was expanding. And these were countries that were typically countries in which English was learned as a foreign language, places like Japan, Korea, and where English played no role within the country itself. It was learnt in classrooms. But it is that area that has really been the one of major change. So people in expanding circle countries are now learning English. China's an excellent example. But they're learning English in order to communicate with people from other countries. So they're not necessarily using it for within-country use, although they are, but they're also using it in order to communicate internationally with fellow multilingual speakers who are not native English speakers. So Chinese are learning English to communicate with Japanese and so forth.
Okay, thank you. You also talk about models of English, and you talk about an exonormative and an endonormative model. What do you mean by this?
An exonormative model is when a country, let's say Malaysia, adopts a model of English that is not indigenous to the country. So it might adopt English that is spoken by the British, so British English as a model. This is an exonormative model. In other words, the norms come from outside the country. It could, of course, also adopt an endonormative model of English. In other words, a model of English that is developed within the country, endonormative, and then say, right, standard Malaysian English will be the classroom model. So in that case, that would be an endonormative model.
In your book, you point out that it's often the case that exonormative models are being preferred, and this has distinct disadvantages, I think, for both teachers and for learners. Could you expand on that, please?
Well, one of the disadvantages of sort of implementing or forcing an exonormative model on local teachers and students is that it's a model that the teachers themselves don't command or use, and they're often judged as being deficient precisely because they don't actually command the model that the ministry has decided must be the model for the classroom. This makes English language teachers all over the world feel uncomfortable, and they lose self-confidence and self-esteem because they feel the variety of English that they speak, that might be an endonormative model like Malaysian English, is somehow deficient because it is not the model from outside. So it's prejudicial against teachers, local teachers. It's also prejudicial against learners because learners actually will not be able to acquire that model. Not only won't they be able to acquire it, but it's also very often irrelevant and inappropriate for them anyway. They need local models that are relevant to them.
Okay, so you think that, or you seem to be saying that an endonormative model would be more practical in many instances.
Yes, or what we might call a multilingual model. In other words, the great number of people who are learning English now are multilinguals who are learning English as a second or third or fourth language. And they're using English with other multilingual people. And those people might be useful sources of linguistic models for classrooms in multilingual societies rather than monolingual native speakers mm-hmm. in particular. However, one can never overlook stakeholder demand here, and parents and so forth are often very keen to have their children learn what they consider to be a native speaker and thus superior model. But one of the jobs of applied linguists, I think, is to try and put alternative thoughts and ideas backed by empirical research into the minds of ministries or on the tables of ministry officials so that we try and persuade them to shift. That's what our job is, I suppose.
And are you winning the war, so to speak?
I guess to develop your metaphor, we've won a couple of small battles. I don't think we've won the war yet, but it'll be a long campaign.
Okay. Thank you. I suppose detractors or people who don't understand or support the idea of the endonormative model will ask, can it ever truly be codified?
Yes, well, the idea of codification being the answer to everyone's problems is a certain myth anyway, because one of the things that we know about language is that they're dynamic and constantly change. But if we go back to the idea of a multilingual model, if the government policy is to develop a multilingual citizenry, it seems reasonable to then propose that why not identify a successful multilingual from that group, that country, and use his or her variety of English or multilingual use of language as a source of models for the classroom. These then become relevant and are easily identifiable by the children in the classroom as being useful and valuable to them. That would be the argument there.
Okay. Where does this all leave the native speaking teacher then?
Well, everyone's a native speaker of something by some, you know, depend how you define it. It's not an issue of native speakerness or speakerdom or whatever the word might be. It's a question of being multilingual, I think. So I think language teachers really need to be multilingual to show that they've had some experience themselves of second language and third language learning, and also being able to use the language of the children in countries like Hong Kong, for example, where most of the children are Cantonese. If you can speak Cantonese to the children, far from being a disadvantage, I believe it to be a great advantage, not just linguistically, which it is, but also culturally, because you can share the same kind of space, both culturally and linguistically, mm-hmm. with your students. I think it's very important.
Okay, so where does this leave the monolingual English language teacher?
Well, I think it should, and this may sound a bit cruel, I think it should leave the English monolingual language teacher at home. and possibly looking for a different career. That may sound pretty harsh, but I do think language teachers these days in this multilingual world really do need to be multilingual and also multicultural. So, and while these things may not be synonymous, multilingualism and multiculturalism often go hand in hand, and people who have experience of learning different languages in different cultures are likely to be more efficient language teachers than people who have not had that experience.
Okay, Andy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.